Let's now talk about socialism, the conversation we had last time that we did not finish. And to get you up to speed where we left off, socialism is something that grows up before Marx. It is a response to capitalism. Socialism has always been the critical response to capitalism. Those of you who think that socialism is something that can disappear, might disappear, or even has disappeared, I would urge you to think again, because I think what socialism has always been is capitalism's shadow. The longer we have capitalism, the longer you can be sure we will have socialism, because it is capitalism's self-criticism. It has been generated by capitalism. As capitalism spread around the world, socialism spread a few minutes behind, and that has always been the case, and it hasn't changed. And that, I think, is an important thing to keep in our minds. Why was it called socialism, this critique of capitalism? This is also extremely important. It was called that because capitalism was identified with individuals. Individuals struggling to make a business, to make the business grow, to gather wealth into their hands. And it created then a gap between those individuals who did that for whatever reason and all the other people who didn't for whatever reason. The employers versus the employees. Those who gathered the wealth and the power into their hands versus those who didn't. And as that system developed, it developed criticism. First, not so surprisingly, from the victims of the process, the people who had nothing, the people who lost in the process, the people who weren't able to compete, the people who had things stolen from them, whatever. And then there were the critics who looked at this system the way it worked and said, this isn't moral, this isn't ethical, this isn't beautiful, this is something that we as human beings can and should do better than. So you had victims and critics, and they tried to develop an alternative. And the alternative they fumbled and bumbled their way to came to be called socialism. Why? Because the idea was we shouldn't have a society where a small group of people control the wealth and power, run the industries, and the rest of us depend on them. We rather think of the society this way. Production is a social activity we all participate in. The wealth that's created in a society is based on what we all as human beings do, plus what the earth, which no human being put there, enables us to have. It's a social, it's a community activity. And socialism then meant we should socially organize production, socially decide who gets what, socially distribute the power amongst ourselves in a way that we can all deem moral and decent and fair. And so the idea was capitalism is a system, to be blunt about it, for the few individuals who either inherit the wealth or steal the wealth or make the wealth by dint of hard labor, that too, but who distinguish themselves not by the work they did, the quality of the work they did, but by the wealth they've amassed and the power they've accumulated. And that comes at the expense of everybody else, and that produces a society torn apart by what our man here said, envy, bitterness, rancor, anger, and all of those other things. And the socialists said, no, let's not do that. And particularly, once Marx becomes the thinker for this movement, which only happens after socialism is already there, when he becomes a thinker, his focus is, let's be sure to organize the system of production in an equal, democratic way, because that way we can make sure that the wealth is fairly distributed and the power is fairly distributed. Now that's what socialists were. They were for a different system. Okay? And they grew strong with capitalism. Capitalism began in the 18th century relatively weak, still fighting with the feudalism out of which it came. Across the 19th century, capitalism took over Europe and came to the United States and went to Japan and became the colossus it was in the 20th century. But at the same time that capitalism becomes global and strong, so does socialism, because socialism is capitalism's shadow. It goes where capitalism goes, and it becomes strong as capitalism does. At least that's been the pattern for most of our history. So socialism spreads and becomes a global movement. And the socialists, as they feel their strength, particularly in places like Germany, to some degree England, the socialists began to develop intellectuals, leaders, and people who began to debate, how are we socialists going to do what we want? We don't want to be the shadow of capitalism. We don't want to be what's always there with capitalism in the front and we the shadow behind. No, we want to replace capitalism with socialism. We want a society that is egalitarian in its distribution of wealth and income and democratic in its distribution of power. Equal distribution of wealth and income, equal distribution of power. Democracy, equality. We want that system. We don't want capitalism. How are we going to do it? And so the first big split, if you like, in the history of socialism has to do with that discussion. First, what everybody agreed on. We went through this last time, but I want to do it again. What everybody agreed on was the way you get from capitalism to socialism is for the socialists to grab the state, get the government, become the power. It was clear to socialists from the earliest days that the capitalists knew how to get a hold of the government and make it do for them. The businesses called in the government troops to hold down the strikers. The businesses called in the government to prevent students from marching down the street, etc., etc. So the trick was get the government. And the socialists felt good about that because they said two things. One, we got the majority. The capitalists, by definition, are few. They're rich, but they're few. The workers are many. We're speaking to the workers. We want a new system better for the world. We will have the majority. Yeah, said others, that may be, but they're very smart, those rich capitalists. They will block it in every way they can. So then, having decided that the state is what you have to get, here comes the first split. One group said, the way you get the state is by making a revolution. You take the government from the capitalists, from those who have it, and you turn it over so it serves the socialist objective, which is to make a transition from capitalism to socialism. And their model was the French Revolution. Why? Because that's what happened there. The rising capitalist middle class made a violent revolution where they cut off the heads of the Louis whatever 16, and so his family and friends and traveling tourists, whoever was in the way in Paris, they cut off the heads. This was a violent political revolution, but it was the end of French feudalism and it ushered in French capitalism. So it's not at all surprising that part of the socialist movement were people committed to the idea revolution is how you get the state, and we ought to make a revolution. We ought to organize in a way that's revolutionary, that has discipline, and that can pull off the kind of revolution against capitalism that the French had done so remarkably against feudalism. But there was a split. And there were a lot of other socialists who said, no. It's a different ball game. You can't do that. The capitalists have ways of preventing you. And even if you could, it's not the way we should make the revolution. We have a different plan. Because our interests as socialists are the same as those of the majority, the workers, here's what we should do. We should organize politically. We should do what Kishama Sawant did. This is long before she was born. We need to form political parties and go out and get the mass of people to vote for us. And by winning elections, we will capture the state. And that's what they did, particularly in Germany. You had a tremendous struggle in Germany between the revolutionary socialists and the evolutionary socialists. The revolutionary socialists, in case you ever have the chance, read this stuff. It's a wonderful way to understand things, even now. They're the names Rosa Luxemburg, probably the most important theorist of revolutionary socialism in Germany. I mean, she was actually Polish, but she worked in Germany. Karl Liebknecht, another leader of the German left. Lenin in Russia, who was part of that group, and so on. But there was this other guy in Germany, Edward Bernstein was his name, and he wrote a book called Evolutionary Socialism, and he became the great thinker. No, no, don't make revolutions. Those don't work. They cause grief, and they don't go there. Do it this other. And socialists have been split about that ever since. That split is not over. That split is here, and that split is reproduced. Every little radical group that wants to change sooner or later replays that struggle. If you're not aware of that, go check. Read the history of, I don't know, the Black Panthers. Read the history of the Young Lords. Read the history of any organizational movement that gets going, and you will see. You know, Stokely Carmichael was one thing, Martin Luther King was another thing, etc., etc. And often inside these people, the same fight was going on inside the individual, which way to go, and they didn't always go the same way. They changed over time. At the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century, two things happened. First, the revolutionary socialists had some victories. Number two, the evolutionary socialists had some victories. Oh, gosh, it wasn't resolved. Turns out both strategies could, under certain conditions, win. The Bolsheviks in Russia made a violent revolution and took the state. So did the people with Fidel in Cuba, so did the people with Mao in China. Meanwhile, in a number of European countries and elsewhere, socialist parties became big enough to become the government. In France today, the Socialist Party is the president, has the majority in the National Assembly, and has the majority in the Senate. It's a completely socialist government in France today, and they are not the only one. So you have people who won in the parliamentary political road, and you have people who won in the revolutionary road.
But the people who won by the parliamentary road did not abolish capitalism.
Yeah, we're coming to that. We're coming to that. They captured the state. They captured the state. That's what they thought was their strategy. That's what they had agreed on. They just disagreed on how to do it. And now we have some who captured it by revolution and some who captured it by evolution or evolutionary means. So now they have this state. And now the question is, what do you do when you have the state? What do you do? There are jokes, you know. There's a famous joke that Fidel Castro used to tell people who visited, that after the revolution, he called, after they won, they got Batista out of Cuba and he was flown to wherever he went into exile. And they all sat around, and Che Guevara raised his hand and said, "What the hell do we do now?" Because really, they've been fighting a guerrilla war for years. They knew how to do that. And they had persevered, and they had won. But when it comes to the next step, what to do, they really didn't know. So what they did was, first of all, to try to use their language, stabilize the situation. A revolution is a trauma. It's a trauma for a society, just like major upsets in a personal life are traumas for us. So the first thing you want to do is kind of get things going again so that the buses run and the food is on the table and people have a sense, okay, we made a revolution, but our lives are going to continue, aren't they? Please? So one of the first things that a revolutionary government does is try to get production going again, get the food and the clothing and the transportation to work. And they ask the workers to come in and do the work. without which the society can't work. And they call it their patriotic duty to socialism to come and get things going again. Successful revolutionary governments, whether they got in by revolution or by evolution, all did that. They all tried to get things going again, figuring that was their first and most important priority. Otherwise, they'd lose the support of the very people who had made the revolution, and that would undo what they had just achieved. So they called the workers back in, everywhere. And when they called them back in, the workers were organized in the offices, in the stores, in the factories, the way they had always been organized. That's what they knew how to do. They knew how to work in what part of the factory, and they looked to this person to give them the instructions and do the super. They reconstructed what they had. The difference was, this is now so crucial, the difference was that the capitalists, the employers, had been told, you are not welcome here anymore. You got to stay home. If you want to come to work, you're a worker like everybody else. And if you have stocks in your own company or others, tear them into little strips and put them in the bathroom, because that's what they're going to be used for. Stock market is closed. You don't own anything, because this is socialism. We all own the factories, the land, the stores, because that's what socialism meant. And we're all citizens of the new socialist government that is going to make all of this work. Well, then who played the role of order giver in the factory, the store, or the office? State officials. The government sent people in, some of them, by the way, the same individuals who had been playing those roles before in the private capitalism, but that had their hearts committed to the society, and they were willing to come and work under the new arrangements. But what you had was the state, this is so important, taking over the functions that capitalists had performed before. Lenin gives an amazing speech 2 to 3 years into the revolution. Lenin, and he announces to the Russian people, what we have created here, he said, is state capitalism. Lenin, he said, and that's a good thing, because the state, as the employer, now is in a position to make the transition to where there's no employer at all. Remember what socialism is, the end of employer-employee. No slave, no master, no serf, no lord, no employee, no employer. Socialism is the democratization of all of that. So Lenin said, we've created state capitalism. What does that mean? It means that the state functions just like any other capitalist. He hires workers. He puts them to work. They make the stuff. Then they go home, and the state officials are the ones who decide what's going to happen here, what technology is going to be used, what if there's profits to be made, how they... The state is the capitalist. State officials function as capitalists. And what that means is, if you've never thought like this before, this will help you, that capitalism can either be private or state. And it turns out, once you understand that, that all capitalisms ever have had both of these things. Let me give you a sense here of the United States, which I think most of you think of as private capitalism. The post office isn't private. It's state capitalism. Amtrak is state capitalism. Public colleges and universities are state capitalism. They hire people. They put them to work. They sell a product. They earn the income. They make a profit. And the officials decide what to do with it. It isn't socialized. Socialized would mean all the people who work in that enterprise together would decide. They don't, that's not what state capitalism does. State capitalism replaces the board of directors of the company elected by the shareholders. That's how that works in private capitalism. In state capitalism, there are no shareholders. The government owns it. And the government puts officials in the position of the board of directors. And by the way, that shouldn't surprise you, because in the other systems, other than capitalism, the distinction between private and state is exactly the same. Alongside the private plantations with private slaves, there were state plantations with state slaves. In many slaveries, you had state and private slave enterprises. Ditto with feudalism. You had the lord, who was a private person with his serfs, but then there was the king, the government in that society, and he had his serfs. That was state feudalism versus private. So we have state capitalism and private capitalism. But because the big experiments with state capitalism, not always, but often, were made by people who were socialists, a fantastic confusion settled in. And that's why I talk about this so much. And the confusion is that state capitalism is socialism. That what socialism is when the state does it. That was never the idea of socialism. Never. But it became a widespread idea. That's why the French Socialist Party can say, yes, well, you know, we have a big public sector here in France. That's socialism. No, that's state capitalism. You can like state capitalism. For example, as was pointed out to me on the way in here today, quite correctly, that when the Soviet Union was formed and they got rid of private capitalism and they brought in state capitalism, that produced huge benefits for the mass of the Russian people. You can have a very good reason to prefer state capitalism to private capitalism. You don't have to. There are some times when the state takes over and replaces the capitalist when you wouldn't want it at all. One of the names we give to state capitalisms that are horrific is the term fascism. That's when the state becomes a very major player, but not with the ideas or the plans or the commitments that a socialist would bring to it, but a very different set of objectives and priorities. The man whose pronouncement is the most important in creating this peculiar equation between state capitalism and socialism was Stalin. He never said what Lenin did. We created a state capitalism and now we have to do the hard job of making socialism. Stalin comes later. And by the time Stalin becomes the leader in the end of the 1920s, the Russian people have already had a decade of suffering, of privation. And he made the political decision, understandable, that he wasn't going to the Russian people and saying like Lenin did, well, we've only come part way. We're at state capitalism. Let's hope, oh my God, the people say, what? Another 10 years of this? He solved the contradiction by declaring it wasn't there. That what the Russians had was socialism. And in that act, he equates the state taking over with socialism. So you didn't anymore have the problem and the question, what do we do when the state is captured by us? There wasn't any more any problem, because capturing the state by socialists was socialism. There wasn't anything more to do. You just had to make it all work out. Russian leaders were very popular in the 20s and 30s by saying things like, all we have left to do is make railroads everywhere and electricity everywhere. We just have to finish the project. But the revolution has happened. This is a strange move. But even stranger is that in the decades since Stalin spoke, people, many of whom hate Stalin and hate Stalinism, they agree with that. They don't even know where they comes from, this idea. But they agree that socialism is what happens when the government takes over. Look, there are millions of our fellow citizens in America who believe that when Obama tries to create a public health insurance system, that makes him a socialist. They don't want it because it's socialist. They've equated socialism and the government. They don't even think about a reorganization of production where everybody has an equal decision-making authority over what gets produced and how it gets produced and what is done with the profits. That idea, which I know, folks, because that's what I spread around the country when I speak. I explain all of it. People who don't like socialism think that's a fundamentally good idea. And I work on that ceaselessly. Because I don't care if they call it lemon meringue pie. If they get the idea and they find it attractive, I'm halfway where I got to get to. Later on, I'll break it to them what it is. Years ago.
Isn't there a difference between what you call state capitalism and regular capitalism? Because of the state capitalism, first of all, is the objective of production necessarily to maximize profits for private owners who own the surplus?
No, because in a state capitalist system, private owners don't own. So that the objectives of the state capitalist do not have to be profit maximization. It can be all kinds of other objectives, and usually are. Because the state is under a whole different set of pressures. In a private capitalist system, your survival as a capitalist requires you to make a whole set of decisions. In a state capitalist system, you're not under that kind of compunction. You don't have that kind of competition. It's a different system.
So there is an important difference.
Absolutely. There's an important difference. People made revolutions and died in large numbers to go from private capitalism to state capitalism. In the lifetimes of many of us in this room, we've also seen the reverse movement. State capitalisms have been disbanded, undone, canceled, and we've moved back to private capitalism. The word is even there, privatization. That's when countries sell off their assets. The Europeans are now putting enormous pressure on Greece to sell publicly owned assets. The water company, the transportation, all kinds of government enterprises are to be sold off to become private because the ideology of private capitalism is that when the state takes over, terrible things happen. But this is a very primitive ideology. For every example of a private capitalist who's more efficient than a state counterpart, I will gladly provide you with the reverse example. The notion that private capitalism is the soul of evil and state capitalism solves all problems was a naivete and a primitive notion of socialists. But the reverse is every bit as stupid. That's the notion that we have here in the United States, that the minute the government touches something, it turns to crap. It can't be done. The worst examples I've ever heard of in this country are really the funniest. They take things like the post office and the railroads. The reason the post office and the railroads lose money is because the role of government takeover of those enterprises was to provide a subsidy to private capitalists. That's why that was done. The reason we don't have a private postal system and we don't have a private passenger rail system is because when you have a person or an enterprise in that position, it has a structural monopoly and it rips everybody off. And how does everybody getting ripped off prevent that? The state takes over and you dictate that you will set these rates and these rates and these rates, which are the rates that everybody who buys the service wants. That means they lose money. But that's not because they're inefficient. That's because they were set up to do that. That was their role. In the United States, we only make things public when the rest of the private sector can get together and make that work for them. And the minute they think it's not working for them, goodbye your public enterprise. They want public enterprises that lose. The only thing cleverer than making the government basically subsidize every other capitalist by taking over this one, the only thing cleverer than that is then saying that the reason they're losing money is that public enterprise isn't deficient. I mean, this is colossal nuttiness, but it has a very powerful ideological function. Now Marx. Where does Marx fit into all of this? Marx enters this debate. He's born into it, and it's part of his life. He loves the French Revolution. He loved those slogans, liberty, equality, fraternity. He wrote them as a young man. He made poetry and all the... That was his, as was true for many Europeans at the time. But he was a very reflective fellow, majored in philosophy. Those kinds of people tend to ask good questions. And he asked himself the following good question, which I guess has occurred to many of you as well. Human beings have been striving for a very long time to have equality and democracy, whatever the words were, to share the wealth equally. Not that everybody gets the exact same dollar amount. You know what I mean. Some will get more, some will get less, for 100 different reasons that the community will discuss and agree on. But we don't create billionaires and poverty. We don't do that. We just don't. Equality. That's why every movement of social revolution or social evolution worth remembering puts the word equality up high on its banner and puts the word democracy. Equal sharing of wealth and income, equal sharing of power. That's been a dream and a goal. So Marx, the philosopher, says to himself, loads of people have made this point. Loads of people have struggled and died to get this equality. And we've made progress. We don't allow some people to be the slaves of other people. We don't allow some people to be landlords and other people have nothing. We've made some strides. But have we achieved equality of wealth and income and equality of power? No. And so I have, Marx says, I have to ask the question, why not? Why were all these efforts by all these people costing so many lives in so many ways, why didn't they work? And the answer Marx gives is, I'm going to figure that out, and that's going to be my contribution. I'm not going to do what everybody else did because it didn't work. I'm going to try to figure out why we haven't been able to get the equalization of wealth and power that we have as a species struggled for thousands of years. And he came up with his answer. He said, in the past, people have tried to overcome the gaps in wealth and income by squashing them together with a law or a tax or a rule. And they've tried to do something about unequal power by a law or a tax or a rule. It didn't work. They either couldn't get the rules passed, or they got them passed and it didn't have the result they wanted, or they got the result they wanted, but the result didn't endure. For one reason or another, it didn't work. And Marx said, there's a reason for it. I figured it out. We never paid attention to something that shapes the distribution of wealth and power. And because we didn't, all of our efforts to make equal distributions came to nothing. The thing that shapes wealth and power fundamentally is how we as a community produce the goods and services that we depend on. Other people hadn't seen that. He said, that's where we have to look. We have to look at how we organize production. If we organize production such that a few people are in a special position of power and control, we can kiss the effort to get equality goodbye. We're not going to get it. Even if we declare everybody equal, this production system will undo that in its normal way of functioning. You will not get equal distributions of power, i.e. democracy, or the equalization of wealth and income, unless you produce those on the foundation of a radically altered production system, by which he meant, because he spelled it out at least loosely, what we would nowadays call worker co-ops, for lack of a better term.
That was never his position.
Let me just finish the argument. The associated workers, which is the phrase he used and which is the phrase he described, just like his term of what he called primitive communism, was an understanding that there's something about organizing production so that all the workers together, make the decisions what we're going to produce, how we're going to produce, where we're going to produce, and what we do with the profits that our collective labor helped to produce. To democratize that process, to create a production system in which we share the decision making, will secure that we don't divide the outputs so that one person gets everything and the rest have nothing, and will cultivate in the people, in this activity, which is where they spend most of their lives, 5 out of 7 days, 8 in the morning till 5 in the afternoon, how you live your life at work is more about shaping the rest of your life than anything else. That has to be the foundation. And so he set himself the critique of capitalism in a particular way. The point was to show, that's what Capital as a Book does, the point was to show that when you overthrow the slave master, and when you overthrow the lord and the serf, but you substitute employer-employee, you have left in place an unequal production system. Capitalism, therefore, isn't the vehicle, the means to achieve liberty, equality, and fraternity. Capitalism is the obstacle. Capitalism is a way of organizing production that precludes the effort to equalize distributions of wealth and income or distributions of power. In 1960, Michael Harrington writes a book, The Other America, famous book in which a whole generation of Americans discover that there's a lot of poor people in America, a lot of them, and they're all over the place. And people were shocked. Here we are, half a century later, and Barbara Ehrenreich or a dozen others will write us and point out, if we need it again, that we've had half a century of thinking we were able to solve that problem, but we haven't. And that's not because good people didn't try this rule, that regulation, this law, this plan. But if you don't transform the production process, if you don't analyze how some people produce surplus for other people who use it to maintain themselves in a dominant position, which is what capital does, and which then leads to the conclusion, that's what has to be, that's what Marxism contributes. The transformation of the system of production as a necessary component to any project for equality and democracy. That if you let me finish. This is not a dialogue. This is a presentation, and you can wait like everybody else.
Okay.
Yes, we can all have our difference of opinion, but let me finish the point. The reason you focus on production is precisely in order to bring that in to the conversation, to make sure that the projects from now on, the projects coming after Marx, don't make the mistake that the projects before Marx made. That's his contribution. It's not, you don't pay attention to Marx because he is some guru who has figured everything out or that everything he says is correct. That's all childish. We don't need that, and Lord knows we don't want to go there. But not to figure out what he has contributed is the equivalent of thinking that the only way to start a fire is by rubbing the sticks together. We have figured things out. Beyond that, we don't need to rely on the sticks. And the reason Marxism is important is because it focuses us the way no theorist had done before on the specific way in which the organization of production under capitalism operates as the obstacle to the project of equality and democracy that so many people over so many generations has struggled for. And that means that a socialism, if it's informed by Marxism, is a socialism that puts the reorganization of production first and foremost on its list of priorities. It's a socialism which, if it can capture the state, remembers from the 19th century that the point of capturing the state was to make transformations. So let me conclude with an example of a society that seems to be fumbling its way in that direction. Q Cuba erected a state capitalism following the model of the Soviet Union, China, and so on. The state became the dominant employer, and it hired large numbers of people, etc., etc. But Cuba being a poor country and being a monoculture, very heavily dependent on the sugar in which it exported and so on, was put into great difficulty with the American embargo, etc., etc. And so they became dependent, long story, on the Soviet Union, which bought the sugar, etc., etc., and enabled that society to continue. The Soviet Union is not in a position to do that anymore. The Cuban economy needs to diversify. They always did. But they're having enormous troubles. And to solve the troubles of their difficult state capitalism, they've made a remarkable decision. They are going to try now to create a transition from state capitalism to worker co-ops. They are at the forefront in all of Latin America in the effort to create an elaborate system of worker co-ops, doing it not only as an immediate solution to the network of problems they have, practical problems, but also coming out of this long-standing notion that socialism cannot just be about what we call macroeconomic changes. It can't just be about who owns and who plans. It has to also have a micro component, a transformation at the base of society, in which the working places, where the wealth is created, are in the immediate control of masses of people. One of the critiques of the Soviet Union, or for that matter of China, have been that somehow they did not have institutionalized the kinds of democracy which, had they had it, might have allowed them to survive in their earlier form. Yeah, but that's just an empty conversation. Unless you have something concrete to say about how you would institutionalize such democracy, that's what worker co-ops would do, because that puts in the hands of the workers the wealth, the basic, the factory, the office, the store, that's where the wealth of a society is created, and on the land. And if those institutions are in the hands of the people in the sense of a democratically run worker co-op, then you have an institution at the base of society that can hold the government accountable, that can make sure that there's democratic responsibility. Otherwise, you're just wishing for it, but not finding any way to anchor it in some place that will work. So, okay, one or two questions. Sure.
Every modern nation state has an economy and a political system, and as you discussed, the workers run cooperatives where people actually discuss, you know, and they have sort of democracy at the workplace. Can you address the political system and avoiding the leadership and the leaders who might, you know, and avoiding the bureaucracy and having sort of like a participatory democracy or horizontalism on political level, not just at the workplace?
Yeah, I mean, if I had time, and maybe I'll take another one of these months talks to talk in detail about what we know about worker cooperative economic systems and their politics. But if I had the more time, I would say to you that, of course, if you're going to be democratic about a workplace, then the decisions about what happens cannot only be made by the workers in the workplace. Because what happens in a workplace affects the community around that workplace. What you spew into the air from your smokestack, what traffic you bring into the environment, what the people who come out of your workplace think and do in the community where they reside with their families. The activities in the workplace have a political consequence, and vice versa. What goes on in the community impacts what happens in the workplace. Therefore, any democratization will have to put together a kind of co-respective government, a political system that no longer operates with an iron wall between the politics and the economics, that the democratic political activity in the residential part of life has to be interconnected and interdependent with the democratic activity in the work part of the same people's lives. And there are examples of societies where this has been grasped. In the early years of the Weimar Republic in Germany, there were a parliament based on where you worked and a parliament based on where you lived. And the idea was these two things have to be somehow coordinated. They have to be democratically interdependent. That would be the direction that I would talk about in terms of how to anchor a new society that has doesn't have the divisions between economics and politics that we're used to.
Yeah, actually, I'm a retired New York City teacher who is receiving a pension right now. But anyway, in the 20th century in America, and to a lesser extent, I think, in Europe, where it was somewhat different, a social contract was established between the working class and those in power. And you've mentioned that capitalism can no longer fulfill this part of the social contract. Marx talks about a declining rate of profit, which I think is related to this and can be related, obviously, to globalization. And I was wondering if in the next session you can describe why the system can no longer meet their end of this social contract in terms of compensation and, you know, a standard of living.
I understand your question. It's a good one. I wouldn't argue that it can't. I think it can.
Oh, I would argue that it can.
Yeah, it can, but it isn't gonna, because there isn't the politics to make that happen. It's not that we don't have a physical problem of taking care of the people on this planet. We haven't had that for a long time. That's just not the case. What we have is a political problem about who wants what share of what, therefore leaving for those who are left, who can't force it for themselves, what it is that they want. I don't believe, just, you know, my perspective, I don't believe that this is a problem of technological or limited capacity for us to do that. I mean, it doesn't take much arithmetic to take a look at the GNP, not that that's a final decision, but to take a look at the GNP and divided by the number of people on the planet and begin to talk about how you could take care of everybody in a certain minimally decent way to show that we can do that. We've been able to do that for quite a while, even with our elevated population that we have now because of the technologies that we've developed and so forth. And that is not to be disrespectful of the climate problems and the natural problems. But I think well, for me, what's important to look at is the organization of the society, economically and politically, that determines how the resources get used, what they're used to produce, and how that product is then divided up in the community. Those are the questions around which it seems to me the struggle ought to go. A couple more, and then we'll stop. Yeah, just because we have to get out of here by virtue of the agreement with the church.
I will look into it, sir. I wonder what happened to Yugoslavia. The system of production was exactly what you pretend would be good.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you know, there are many examples that if we get into, which is something we can do, if we get into talking about worker co-ops and the efforts that have been made throughout history to have a democratic work process, these are very old. This is not a new idea. This has been around for centuries. Some of the best practices of collective democratic decision-making in the United States, for example, take place in monasteries and nunneries where the religious folk have gotten together to make jam and do it in a remarkable way, which for them is the ethical equivalent of what we're talking about. Here's another example that will surprise you. Every year in the last 30, engineers who work for some of the biggest high-tech companies in Silicon Valley outside of San Jose in California quit their jobs. These are people making $200,000-$300,000 a year. They quit their job. And they get together with 5, 10, 15, 20 other friends of theirs, and they all take their laptops into somebody's garage in the back of their house. And they make a decision. We can't stand working for IBM or Cisco or any of the other big giants. We hate coming to work with a tie and a jacket. We hate that supervisor who tells us what to do. We hate being unable to bring a frisbee. We hate being unable to come high. We hate all that. So we're going to make our own business. And in our own business, we're going to be completely different. Everybody's equal. I've been to these places. They're there. Everybody's equal. No bosses, no bossed. Monday to Thursday, we come and we work on the software or whatever it is we make. Friday, we come and we sit around all day. We have meetings and we decide what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. When I've talked to these groups, I've discovered, one, they're mostly Republicans. They are. They think of what they've done as entrepreneurial innovation. And I go back and I say to them, as I say to you, lemon meringue pie, I don't care. But I got to break it to you. You're doing just what Marx had in mind. And what do you think about that? They're aghast. Then they start to laugh because they understand the absurd irony that they have done. And then I start tutoring them. See, you know what you did? You made a critique of capitalism, but a real one. You walked away from it. You quit. You said, you don't have for me what is going to keep me here. I don't care that you give me 200 grand a year. I want a different life. I want to come with my kid. I want to come with my dope. I want to come with my Hawaiian shirt. And I want to be, I want to do things, but it's very important. I want to do things in a radically different way. And let me provoke you with this. I don't want you to see it as just some sort of humor here, because serious. Many of the great innovations made in Silicon Valley over the last 50 years were not made by capitalist enterprises, folks. They were made by communist enterprises. That's why those people quit those jobs. And if you ask them, they say, I'm 50 times more productive working in this garage with the other friends of mine than I ever was in, whoa. Then it turns out that what capitalism boasts of, its great breakthroughs in Silicon Valley, weren't made by capitalists at all. They were made by refugees from capitalism who set about producing an enterprise that is precisely what we're talking about. And you shouldn't even be depressed by this. Do you think the people who began to create capitalist enterprises out of the breakdown of feudalism in 16th and 15th century Europe, you think they were aware they were starting capitalism? They had no idea. The word didn't exist. They did something that made sense to them, which a century later became conscious and got its name. So it's not surprising that there are engineers in San Francisco or in the Bay Area who are figuring out that they don't want to live in a capitalist enterprise, they don't want to work in one, they want something else. And if they want to call it an entrepreneurial innovation, people like me will get to them soon enough and they'll change the name. Look, we've run out of time. Thank you very much. I will see you in July.